It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about a unique exchange program that recently brought some German police officers to Wisconsin.
First, Wisconsin is one of two states in the country without a finalized state budget. The other state is Connecticut. For Wisconsin lawmakers, there are a number of sticking points, chief among them how to fund and pay for road repairs and other projects.
But the plan to build a Foxconn plant in Wisconsin could make passing a budget even more complicated.
Laurel White is our in-house state capitol reporter. She's with us to give us the latest. Laurel, welcome back.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, what's the latest? This is getting more and more overdue. What do we know about where it stands now?
Well, it's just getting more and more complicated because of that Foxconn package that you guys mentioned. One of the biggest hang-ups with the state budget right now is just kind of how the Foxconn package plays into that. So we did get a couple answers on that today because of a new fiscal estimate from the state legislature's budget office. But lawmakers are still kind of holding out and waiting to make any budget decisions until they're able to process that a bit.
So how is this affecting it? Is the Foxconn deal being written into the budget, or is separate Foxconn legislation maybe going to have this fiscal impact that maybe makes some of the numbers currently in the budget less meaningful?
Well, sort of a bit of both. So an interesting piece of overlap between the Foxconn package and the state budget that's currently being negotiated is about $250 million in borrowing for a construction project on I-94 north-south in southeastern Wisconsin, which is where the Foxconn facility would be built. So as you know, the transportation budget was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, sticking point in the state budget. So a little bit of overlap there. If the Foxconn package is approved, that project is approved, that amount of bonding is approved. And as you might remember, Assembly Republicans in particular were concerned about a level of bonding that high in the state budget. So they might have some concerns about that in the Foxconn package, or because it's the Foxconn package and not the budget, they might decide it's worth it in that instance.
Yeah, and the latest on the transportation budget, even before this Foxconn deal, as I understand it, set me straight if I'm wrong, Assembly Republicans had wanted more revenue. They wanted some kind of tax increase or something. The Senate had wanted not that, none of that, but they wanted more borrowing. But the Assembly Republicans said no borrowing, and that's where it stuck, right?
Right. So the last big development that we had on the state budget, sans Foxconn, pre-Foxconn, was on July 20th. And that's when Assembly Republicans said that they accepted an offer from Governor Scott Walker to spend $200 million that he had originally proposed in the budget for tax cuts on road projects. So that would lower the amount of bonding to zero. Assembly Republicans were really excited about that. They said, hey, we've got a budget deal, let's move forward. But later that afternoon, Senate Republicans came out and said, we don't like this deal. We wanted to use that $200 million to offset the personal property tax, to eliminate the personal property tax in the state of Wisconsin. So we thought we had a deal on July 20th. Then we had some disagreement between the Assembly and the Senate. Folks were, you know, needing to kind of talk that through. And then the following Wednesday, July 26th, is when this Foxconn deal came out and sort of threw a wrench in all of the state budget negotiations.
So is there a negotiation going on now? Are people still meeting between the Assembly and the Senate to try to hash this out?
I believe so. So that's kind of an interesting thing that happened after this Foxconn deal was announced on July 26th. It became very Foxconn all the time. A lot of discussions about this. Of course, it's a historic proposal for an incentive package to bring a business to Wisconsin. So it makes sense that it sort of, you know, stole some headlines there from the state budget for a little bit. But when lawmakers started talking about Foxconn, a question that reporters asked Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is, what's your priority? Are you prioritizing the Foxconn negotiations or the budget negotiations? And Assembly Speaker Voss said, I think Foxconn should be the priority. The sooner we get this figured out, the sooner the facility construction starts and jobs start coming to Wisconsin, and, you know, we're really interested in that. And then later that day, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said, we think the priority should be the budget. So we know that The Senate is certainly focusing on the budget. They said that that's their priority. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said that he was planning to meet with the Assembly Speaker about budget priorities. Governor Scott Walker has said he thinks the legislature should be able to, quote, walk and chew gum, so kind of figure out the Foxconn thing and the state budget at the same time.
Has there been any argument over, you know, whether it's potato or potato at this point? It sounds like we're at that level where one side says one thing, the other side says no, the other thing.
Well, there's certainly some disagreement about prioritization and, you know, whether these things can happen exactly simultaneously or not. And the fact of the matter is, since the Foxconn deal has come out, we haven't gotten any major revelations about state budget negotiations that are separate from Foxconn. So that could certainly happen. We could certainly get news about that any time now, but there haven't been, you know, exclusively state budget negotiation breaking news events since that July 26th announcement.
Laurel White is with us, state capitol reporter, looking at the state budget and the Foxconn deal. And as she's been saying, they are influencing one another more and more, it seems like. And Laurel, speaking of breaking news, some new data came out about what a Foxconn deal might cost the state, when the state might break even on that. I know this is pretty new out, but you've been tweeting on this earlier. What are we seeing so far?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting development because this is something that state lawmakers have been really anxiously awaiting. This is something that Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald referenced when he said, you know, we want to prioritize the budget. We don't know a lot about the Foxconn deal. We've still got a lot of questions about the Foxconn deal. He wanted to know what the impact was going to be on the state budget that's currently being negotiated. So that estimate that came out today has that financial implication for the state budget. It's not a huge chunk of money. It's about $15.6 million for the 17-19 state budget. And, of course, in context, you know, the state budget, the biennial budget, is about $76 billion this time around. So the Senate now has the answer to that question. We also have the answer to a pretty interesting question for folks debating the Foxconn package as a whole, which is, how worth it are these financial incentives that the state is committing to pay out to Foxconn if they come here, that $3 billion? And we learned today, according to this fiscal estimate, that the state wouldn't break even on that $3 billion incentive package, wouldn't get that amount of money back until the year 2043.
And that, as I understand it, contains some assumptions in it about how many people end up being employed at this still hypothetical Foxconn plant and how many of them are Wisconsin workers versus Illinois workers.
That's right. So that estimate for the 2043 break-even point assumes that Foxconn will eventually employ the maximum number of workers that it's estimated to employ. That's 13,000 people. And it also assumes that those workers will be from the state of Wisconsin and not the state of Illinois. And so that's been a big part of the Foxconn debate. How many of these workers are going to come across state lines from Illinois because the facility is going to be located or would be located in southeastern Wisconsin that's pretty accessible to Illinois? So according to this estimate, if just 10% of the Foxconn workers come from Illinois, that pushes the break-even point for the state well past the year 2045.
Have there been reactions to this so far from lawmakers? Again, I know this is pretty fresh data.
Yeah, it's pretty new. You know, I'm actually getting emails in my inbox now with some of the first reactions. I've got a statement here from the Assembly Minority Leader, Democrat Peter Barca, and he says he's, quote, extremely concerned about the cost to Wisconsin taxpayers. He says the fiscal analysis released today creates new questions. So we're getting some pushback from this fiscal analysis already from some of the Democrats that have raised concerns about this package before. It'll be interesting to see what the majority Republicans think about these fiscal estimates.
Getting back to our starting point, the state budget, we don't have one. It is overdue, more than a month past due now. But in some ways, we can't oversell that point because We have a functioning budget in effect in Wisconsin, right? The old budget just keeps rolling until the new one gets in place. It's not a disaster.
Right, right. The state of Wisconsin is not like the federal government that shuts down if there's no new state, if there's no new budget. The way the state works is that if there isn't a new budget approved, we just continue operating from the previous approved biennial budget. So some people have said that could cause some problems a couple months down the line when we run out of money to do road projects, some of the majors, as they're called, big construction projects. When we get closer to the school year, schools might have some concerns about funding levels, but that is, in the weeks and months ahead at this point.
I know you have no crystal ball to predict when a budget is going to be in place, but is there a sense that there's any kind of light at the end of the tunnel, or are we where we were a month ago?
It's so hard to say. I wish I had that crystal ball. It would make my my job a lot easier, but I do know...
We'll get that in the budget next year.
Yeah, exactly. That would be great. So we do know that they want to get, particularly folks like Assembly Republicans, get the Foxconn package figured out pretty quickly. They were hoping to vote on that on the Assembly floor by the middle of this month. So if the Foxconn package gets wrapped up, that would probably mean good things for getting the state budget wrapped up. But as of today, right now, both of those seem to be in pretty complicated places.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, joins today with the latest on the state budget holdup. Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll find out what City of Altoona is hoping to learn from an international police exchange program. Stay with us here on Central Time. Altoona, Wisconsin recently welcomed some unique visitors to the city. Thanks to an international exchange program, five German police officers recently came to the Chippewa Valley and are currently embedding with Altoona's police department.
The idea behind the program is to expose visiting officers to other perspectives on policing and criminal justice, but there's also plenty that a host city can learn from them, too.
Edward Bell is an Altoona police officer and was responsible for getting the city involved with the exchange. Officer Bell, thanks a lot for coming on the show today.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, first off, can you tell us how this idea for this exchange, how did it get off the ground?
Well, I moved to the U.S. 7 years ago myself from Germany and began working here as a police officer in several agencies in the area. Growing up for 20 years in Germany, I saw that essentially law enforcement there deals with the same problems we have here. And there's very, very different approaches to deal with that. And I figured it would be a great opportunity for, you know, us to get together and examine that and look at that and see, you know, that there's different approaches to do that. And, some people do, some of them may do that less or more effective. And, it's the platform's there to do that.
Can you give us an example of one of those things you noticed from the approach in Germany where you thought, wow, that really is different the way they handle it?
One of the big things I noticed is when it comes to impaired driving, which is obviously a huge issue in our state as well, that there's much larger, groups of officers that work on that organize in teams to combat that in form of, doing traffic stop saturation in areas. And, of course, the legal process is a bit different when it comes to search warrants for blood. But, it's interesting to see how different the level of training is in that compared to how we structure that here.
So when this idea for this exchange between Altoona and some officers from Germany came up, what did people think? Were people on board?
I'm very amazed at how much support I've received through all of this. I know it started with our administration. I know that my chief, my lieutenant were immediately on board with this. They were very excited at the idea, and essentially everybody I talked to in the surrounding agencies here in Eau Claire and Chippewa counties and the participating agencies, I did not run into a single person that thought they didn't want to be part of this, and that goes as far as the civilians here that have met the officers so far in the community that are all been very welcoming and very interested in the program.
And so when these five officers first came to Altoona, what did you do? What were those first moments and hours like?
The first day when they arrived here, they were picked up at the airport by their host families, which are all officers here in the area. They got to know each other, and the next day we had a little welcoming event where they could introduce themselves, and we just went over, you know, the program for the following 2 weeks. It seemed like everybody on both sides was very excited about that.
And tell us a little bit about what kinds of stuff the German officers are getting to do as they embed with you guys in Altoona, you gals and guys and gals, I should say, in Altoona.
Right. I guess the key point of the program is ride-alongs. They were participating in ride-alongs with seven law enforcement agencies in Eau Claire and Chippewa counties. There's been tours. I know we wanted to show the correctional process and the judicial process outside of law enforcement, how law enforcement work is handled from that point on here. So we did a tour at the Stanley Correctional Institution. We've gone through the Eau Claire County Jail. But, you know, we've got to see a little more specialized units. I know yesterday we saw a demonstration from the Eau Claire County Regional SWAT team. So we're just trying to show off as many aspects of this, of our law enforcement culture as we possibly can.
And what kinds of things did you hear back? Because I imagine there's a lot of conversations going on while this exchange is happening, and probably on their side saying, whoa, you do it like that? And you saying, yeah, how come you do it like this? So what kind of conversations and things have come up for you?
It's pretty much the one conversation that's been going on these last 2 weeks is, oh, you do it this way, we do it this way. I know, if, for example, yesterday was a very good point about that, because in Eau Claire County, the SEK SWAT teams, they have one SWAT team per state, whereas our law enforcement is organized and managed on a local level. So there's a very big organizational difference that brings its, you know, pros and cons on both sides with it. But when it comes down to simple patrol work, I've noticed that we seem to be a lot more on the road here versus it's more of a cultural aspect. If an officer goes into a restaurant here in the United States, it seems like, you know, more often than not, the restaurant owners appreciate us being there and they feel safe while we're there, whereas in Germany it seems like sometimes they might say, well, that person's being paid and they're eating right now, you know. So it's a very big, the cultural perception of law enforcement's very different on both sides.
Edward Bell is with us right now. He's an Altoona police officer joining us to talk about an exchange program that city is taking part in, which recently brought police officers from Germany to the Chippewa Valley. And Officer Bell, I want to ask a little more about that idea about cultural attitudes toward police, because right now in this country, we are in the midst of a fraught moment in relations between police and sometimes the communities they serve. And this has been difficult on both sides. Is that something that the officers in Germany can relate to and have any thoughts about?
Very much so. I feel like the law enforcement culture in both sides has had that difficult moment for different reasons. I know in the German police officers have told me there's been a lot of conflict and tensions through the immigration that has happened there from Syria and from other countries in the Middle East. That's created its own entire set of issues on the political level and on the law enforcement level. Basically, what it comes down to is, you know, both sides are trying to keep communications open and to keep, you know, resolving those issues and to bettering the relations that we have with our communities. I know one of the things the German officers thought was a very interesting idea that they would love to implement is our concept of the National Night Out events that happen throughout the state and nation. They were all able to participate in the National Night Out event in Eau Claire, and there was a very positive feedback from them to see how many people come out and you know, try to speak with us and to interact with us there.
And tell us a little bit, for folks who may not know about what the Night Out concept is, can you describe it for us?
Yeah, the National Night Out event is a national concept. On the beginning of August, there's a night where local law enforcement sets up in their communities. You know, there's patrol car displays. There's I know we had a dunk tank where officers sat there and kids could throw balls at them. And it's a really fun way to, you know, to have people close to us to show what we work with, how we do it, to talk to them if there's concerns in the community. That's a great time to, you know, approach us in an informal setting and talk about those things. And I think it's a great event. I know the community loves it. There's hundreds of people there that visit every year, And that's one of those things that that those types of events don't really exist over there because law enforcement is organized on a state level rather than a local level. So it's a little harder for departments to personalize towards their individual communities.
And so the officers with Germany sounds like really taken with these night out for police officers in the community. Is there anything from the Altoona end that you've looked at or had these conversations and said, you know what, that's something we could do to better relations with the community?
Well, I think that the way, especially when it comes to the organizational aspects, I feel like because everything is organized on a larger scale over there, sometimes it's easier to react to larger events. For example, when there are tensions or there have been riots related to soccer games, to political events, the law enforcement over there just seems to be more versed with that. It seems to be more easily deployable to those areas in larger numbers to keep the community safe there, whereas we haven't had as many issues with that directly here in Eau Claire and Chippewa counties, but I feel like that's something we can definitely learn from and, you know, to improve our communications on our end.
And Officer Bell, as we wrap up, you've had officers from Germany in Altoona, Wisconsin, in the Chippewa Valley. Is the next step to send officers from Altoona to Germany?
It is. The STAR International Police Exchange organization that we're working with actually has four member countries beside the U.S. and Germany. There's also Spain and Switzerland. And in the following years, we are planning on making this an annual event, an annual exchange, and we'd like to grow with that a bit and include some more agencies in the area. And I have been approached by some agencies that are interested as well. But on top of that, I would also like to facilitate that exchange to include officers from our areas to travel to Germany, Spain, and Switzerland to essentially bring those same experiences home here.
Officer Bell, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Officer Bell is an Altoona police officer who joined us to talk about an exchange program that Altoona is taking part in, which recently brought police officers from Germany to the Chippewa Valley.
Coming up after the news, there are a lot of ways to define what it means to be American. We'll hear what Americans had to say in a recent survey. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
What makes someone an American? Is it about language and religion, where we were born and where we live, or our attitudes toward things like the rule of law and a diverse society?
Those can be controversial questions in a time of divided politics and tension over immigration and citizenship. But a recent survey from the Voter Study Group finds most Americans agree on a lot of key elements of American identity across party lines.
John Sides is an associate professor of political science at George Washington University and editor-in-chief of the Monkey Cage blog for the Washington Post, where he wrote about these survey results. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, John, before we get into the results of the survey, you write about two different ways of thinking about citizenship as an ethnic category on one hand or as a civic category. Can you lay out those two different ways of thinking?
Sure. If we think about citizenship or American identity in terms of ethnicity, we're going to look at who people are. We're going to ask, where are you from? You know, what's your skin color? What's your religion? If we're interested in thinking about American identity as a civic quality, we're going to ask you, you know, what do you believe? Do you support American values, American ideals, American institutions, things like that?
And there seems to be agreement in the survey for the most part. It's the civic stuff there that you just mentioned, those attitudes and ideals that people tend to agree makes us American.
Sure. So the survey comes from December of 2016, and it's asking people how important are each of the following criteria for being American? And the criteria that get the largest majority of people saying that they're important are things like respecting American political institutions and laws, having American citizenship, accepting people of diverse racial and religious backgrounds. I mean, some of those things I think are really probably at the core of who we think we are as a country, our ideals, which not only include, you know, the democratic institutions that we have, but also include this ideal of accepting people of diverse backgrounds. And large majorities of both Republicans and Democrats think those things are important for being an American.
Right. And this is a time when we talk about partisan divides and political tension, including over things like who we are as Americans. Were you surprised to see this level of agreement across parties?
In some sense, really, no. I think that these are just consensual things. I mean, you could certainly say that the devil's in the details in terms of which political institutions and laws or which kinds of racial and religious backgrounds. We can get to that in a minute. But I do think that these things are and have been for quite some time really at the core of what Americans think about who they are. I mean, if you go back to some of, you know, our founding documents, you look at the rhetoric of political leaders. I mean, I think one of the things that has always been held up as a crucial part of the American experiment has been a body of beliefs. You know, we have never been a country that's been founded on, you know, one particular ethnicity, one particular religion, one particular skin color. We've always had diversity in those things, but what we have had in common is a set of beliefs about, you know, how we should structure our government and what we should aspire to as a people.
There does seem to be tension, and it may be something that this didn't quite get into, but over, as you say, which kind of diversity, which religious groups fit into that diverse mix. One question that was asked on this is, how important is being Christian as part of American identity, and what kind of results did we see there?
So this is overall, you know, something that the approximately 42% of Americans think is important to being an American. So it's clearly not a large majority of people. That said, a quality like being Christian is the one that elicits the most disagreement across party lines. So among Republicans, for example, about 56% of them think that this is an important criterion, but only 30% of Democrats think that. And Trump primary voters were a little bit more likely even than Republicans as a whole to support this. And I think, you know, this divide over being Christian and the importance of being Christian gets at, I think, some of the crucial debates that we have today about, for example, admitting Muslims to this country and whether a group like Muslims can really fully assimilate to this country and support our ideals. And I think there's a lot of question about that and division about that in the public as a whole, and it's reflected in this particular question about the importance of Christianity for being American.
So within the 40% overall, 40% mm-hmm. range overall on being Christian, 50-some percent for Republicans. Compare that to the numbers when people are asked, how important is it to respect American political institutions and laws? What kind of numbers
sure.
were there?
Yeah, so now you're looking at 93% of Americans think that's important. 90% of Democrats, 97% of Republicans. It really is a very, very small number of people who don't put any weight on that.
So again, there seems to be consensus on the civic side of things when you look at the difference in those numbers.
Yes, absolutely.
Talking to John Sides from George Washington University about what it means to be American, as defined by Americans in some recent survey information. A survey asked questions in different categories, asked people to rate how important these things were to American identity, to being an American. Here's one that we haven't gotten into yet. Being able to speak English, John, what did people have to say about that as part of American identity?
Sure. So being able to speak English is something that the majority of Americans thinks is important. About 85%. And there's a little bit more disagreement among the parties there. So, for example, 96% of Republicans think that's important compared to 75% of Democrats. But still, that's 75% of Democrats agreeing with it as well. And I think, you know, one of the things that's been true in the United States, you know, as we've, admitted large numbers of immigrants from a variety of countries stretching back over, you know, the last couple hundred years, is that I think that, you know, having a common lingua franca has been, you know, integral to the goal of I think forming, you know, one people out of these many different groups. And I think Americans today seem to retain a belief that having that is important. It's not to say that the mere presence of other languages in the country is a problem. you know, Americans are going to disagree about that as well. But it's just to say that I think there is more consensus on the question of should English be one of the languages that people can speak.
Now, a piece you've written since you wrote about these survey results looked at white identity, European-American identity, and how that plays into politics. That was one of the questions in the survey. The category was to be of, how important is it to be of European heritage or descent to being an American? Where did that come out in the results?
That's one of the least popular things, actually. About only 20% of Americans say that that's important. Now, whether 20%, I say only 20%, that's low, relatively speaking. Whether that's low or high in absolute terms, of course, will depend on your perspective. And this is not something that's embraced really by either parties. 17% of Democrats, 23% of Republicans say it's important. So, you know, both groups in some sense are rejecting what I think is probably the most overt and exclusive way of defining American identity, at least in the list of criteria that we gave to people.
And you wrote, again, more recently about white identity and how it fits into the Trump campaign and Donald Trump's support. How did Trump supporters break out on this question?
Yeah, so, I mean, most Trump supporters, don't think this is important. About 30% of them say that it's important, which is a little larger than among Republicans as a whole, and I think reflects a little bit about what was distinctive about Trump voters. When I say Trump voters, I'm referring to Trump voters in the primary here, mm-hmm. to kind of isolate his, you know, core group of voters. I think that the role of white identity more generally was certainly important for Trump's rise. And there, I think, the kind of key things that you want to try to measure to identify that is a perception that among whites that, that they're losing out on opportunities to other groups, in particular to non-white groups or minority groups of different kinds. That, I think, is one of the central concerns that if you ask people, to express, how much of a problem do you think it is that whites lose out, or how often do you think they lose out, that's the thing that keeps coming up as being sort of strongly associated with Trump support early on during the Republican primary. So it's not the same as saying that whiteness is important to being an American. I think it's expressing, maybe it's related, but it's expressing a somewhat different idea about the position of whites in the country and how well they're doing relative to others.
John Sides is with us from George Washington University, looking at what it means to be American, with the results of a recent survey showing a lot of agreement on some of the core principles that make someone an American.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What does the word American mean to you? Is it official citizenship, maybe being born in the country, living here? Is it about civic attitudes, maybe accepting the rule of law, embracing a diverse population? Do ethnicity and religion or language play a role? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're talking about what it means to be American. A recent survey finds a lot of agreement among Americans, even during a divided political time. John Sides is with us. He's an associate professor of political science at George Washington University.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your answer to the question, what does it mean to be an American? What matters most? Is it attitude, ethnicity, place of birth, language, religion? You name it, and call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Matt is on the line in Milwaukee. Matt, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Matt?
Yeah, I like to think of the America, the word America, as an idea having to do with freedom and liberty, having similar to what the Founding Fathers had envisioned, most of them at least, and like the Articles of Confederation, civil liberties and economic liberties and whatever may be left of those, similar to what's referred to as the remnant, a group of people that still believe in the values that were around at the time of the founding of the country.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. So, John, Matt saying embracing the values of the Founding Fathers, focusing on the civil and, it sounds like, economic liberties there.
Yeah, that's what I understood him to say, and I think that's at the core of what civic identity is meant to be. And again, it's not to say that we don't have debates about liberty or freedom, how much there should be, what kinds of freedom, and the like. But in some sense, it is still a relatively inclusive form of thinking about American identity, because, you know, there's nothing that I can do to change, you know, my skin color. It's obviously very difficult for people to change their nationality or even their religion. But, to be able to accept a set of ideals is quite, I think, common. And one of the things, I mean, the little story that I used to open up the piece that I wrote about this was a description of a number of people who had taken the oath of citizenship on July the 4th this year, and one of them was an Iranian software engineer. And when he said, when he was asked by the reporter why he wanted to become an American citizen, he said, "I like the system here. I like the rule of law. You know what to expect and what not to expect, so you can plan. That's a major part of why I wanted to be a part of America." And so, you know, embodied in that, I think, is this the civic idea of citizenship.
Thanks for the call, Matt. We'll go next to Goodberger in Osceola. Hi.
Hi, in Osceola, Wisconsin.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, my story is that I immigrated in 2002 through the diversity visa lottery, which I had taken part in for several years. I finally won my green card for myself and my family in 2002. So we had the green card, and I was hired immediately after coming here. But when we became citizens about 6 years ago, that's when I truly felt I had the right to call myself an American.
Well, congratulations on that, and thank you for sharing your story. So for, as you were talking about in the story, you were just sharing, John, we hear there that when you become that citizen officially, that's when people feel American. And getting back to that survey, that a lot of people thought that was pretty important, having that American citizenship.
Yeah, 90% of people said that having American citizenship was important to being an American. And I think that reflects actually a relatively inclusive vision in this country, in as much as that we offer citizenship to people, you know, who are immigrants. And, you know, we obviously there's a process for doing so, but, you know, relative to other countries who have been, I think, more exclusive in their conception of who can get citizenship. You know, many countries do not have the opportunity to become a citizen simply by virtue of being born in the country, right? So we have the birthright citizenship idea here as well. And so in that sense, I think that saying that we think having citizenship is important to being American is really asking kind of a baseline commitment, right, to this country. But given how we do practice the granting of citizenship, it's, you know, obviously it's open to quite a wide range of people.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go next to Tim with us in La Crosse. Tim, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I just wanted to say, I've listened to what everybody has said so far, and I just wanted to say, being an African-American male and living in the United States, my grandmother and her sisters are a survivor of one of the worst race riots in the history of this country, which happened in 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I'm from. And in her lifetime, she probably never dreamed that she would see a black president. But she always raised me to believe that, you know, follow the law, you do the right thing, and, you know, things like what Barack and Michelle did can come true one day. So I remember seeing him, you know, get sworn in the office and how it made me feel, knowing that my grandmother and her sisters would all have loved to have received the blessing of seeing that. And it gave me a lot of hope. And it helped me give a direction to my children, telling them that, see, the American dream does exist. It is real. It's not a pipe dream. But I feel like, you know, when everything played out the way that it did in this election, a lot of people do not want to believe it. But, you know, I worked a campaign, obviously, for the opposition. It's not really important who I supported, but the key is it's like a lot of hate was pumped in order for this election to play out the way that it did. And my 16-year-old daughter even asked me, you know, does this mean that if you do the right thing, things won't pay off for you? And no, I truly believe that they can, but there's a lot of disparaging because, like, I'm an educated person. I attended college, but I also want to point out something, too. I'm alive because of the Affordable Health Care Act.
And Tim, you've given us a lot to get into there, and I want to, before we forget some of the main points, John, getting away from the survey a little bit, people, Tim's background as an African American, not always feeling like they were treated as Americans by others. What do you think?
You know, I think that Tim's good comment hits at one of the challenges of, you know, I think the entire American experiment, which is that, you know, a majority of us can easily agree in the context of a survey where, you know, you're just talking to a person on the phone. It's not the hardest thing to do. That, yes, it's important to accept people of diverse racial and religious backgrounds. That's key to being an American. But then figuring out exactly what that means on the ground and actually creating not just a degree of acceptance, but also a degree of inclusiveness and justice for people who have experienced discrimination. You know, that's what, of course, is proven to be more difficult. And I think Tim also pointed out one other thing that is important, because he mentioned the outcome of this particular election. I think one of the things that, you know, doing polls and surveys can oftentimes tell you is that if you think about public opinion as a whole, I mean, there's, you know, there's enough variation in the way that Americans think about things that, or enough sort of complexity in the way they think about things that different ideas or sentiments can come to the fore. And that's really not going to depend upon the public. You know, that's going to depend upon what politicians and political leaders are doing and saying, you know, what they're asking of the public. If you want the American public, if you want to bring to the fore a conception of American identity that is more exclusive, you can find that in American public opinion, and you can find a substantial number of voters who will agree with parts of that. But if you want to bring forward a vision of American identity that's more inclusive, that's focused on civic ideals and the like, you'll find a lot of people that support that as well. So part of what I was trying to say in this piece was, you know, at times it's not so much important what the American people think or what they tell a pollster. You know, it's important what political leaders are asking them to do. And to the extent that we want a politics of American identity that is less divisive, I think it really starts with the rhetoric and actions of political leaders.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tim, as we talk to John Sides from George Washington University about what it means to be American. Back to our callers. Josie is with us in Madison. Josie, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. What did you think?
I think that your love of country and your pride in being an American is so much more important than things like speaking English. On a personal note, I'm married to an immigrant. He moved here when he was 8. My mother-in-law's lived here for 32 years. She doesn't speak a word of English. I've never had a conversation with her, but she is so proud of being an American. She's been a citizen for about 22 years now, and she owned a restaurant for about 20 years, and her only day she took off every year was the 4th of July. She didn't even close the restaurant the day her son got married.
Josie, thanks a lot for that call. As we start to wrap up, John, you were just talking about maybe lessons from this this survey for political leaders. What are you hoping that we, the public, and political leaders take home from this?
Well, I think that, I mean, one reason I wrote this piece was that I think that we have a lot of conversations about disagreement and division, and I think that's real. I mean, those are based on real differences of opinion about all kinds of political issues. We certainly see political rhetoric that seeks to play on those divisions. And I think I wanted to highlight that there are those divisions, but there are also areas of consensus. So it is possible to have a conversation about core issues in this country and the meaning of American identity itself without having it devolve into an argument. It just depends upon what kind of conversation we're asked to have. You know, if we're going to have a debate about Muslims in this country, that's going to create more divisions. But if we're going to have a debate that says that we think that people who come to this country from a variety of religious faiths can be American by virtue of what they believe, you know, kind of what Josie was articulating there, then that's not going to necessarily provide as much grist for these kinds of divisions.
That's a good place to leave it. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's John Sides, Associate Professor of Political Science at George Washington University. You can read his piece, by the way, on what it means to be an American and all these survey results. We have a link over on the Central Time Facebook page.
If you've been on the internet today, you may have seen a lot of pictures of cats. Okay, we're saying this is like every other day, except you may have seen even more pictures of cats than usual.
Today is International Cat Day, and people have been celebrating by using the internet the way it was intended to be used, as a never-ending source of funny cat pictures and memes.
Along with all those pictures, Merriam-Webster Dictionary reprinted the definition of cat from the 1828 edition of Webster's, and it includes this. The domestic cat needs no description. It is a deceitful animal and, when enraged, extremely spiteful.
Well, not really in the spirit of 2017 International Cat Day, I guess.
No.
But cats have their personalities, for better and for worse.
They certainly do. And we've seen, I think, tons of kitty personalities on the internet.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's okay. It makes us feel better about life, right?
Yeah. And people clearly like dressing up their cats. In funny ways, I saw the entire cast of Gilligan's Island recreated by cats.
By cats.
Or, you know, by cat owners. I don't think the cats made the little Gilligan.
Yeah, the cats did not look to be totally on board.
I don't think so.
I could be reading them wrong, but I didn't think they were completely buying in.
Don't take a cat on that 3-hour tour. I don't think they're going to appreciate
that. Yeah, cats don't like water.
And you have a new kitten.
We do have a new kitten.
So you're
in the
celebrating
house.
Extra.
Yes, she's fabulous. And I have to say, you know what? Cats are okay.
Cats are okay.
I like them.
Words we can all live by here on Central Time.